From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we continue with our Coastline candidate interviews, and on this edition, we're talking with David Rauser. He's North Carolina's Republican congressman from Johnston County in the 7th District. He served one term and is seeking a second. Before winning a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, David Rauser served in the North Carolina Senate for two terms, representing the 12th District. North Carolina's 7th Congressional District stretches from the southeastern coast of North Carolina and encompassing Brunswick, New Hanover, and Pender counties, west to the more rural Columbus, Sampson, Wayne, and Duplin counties. The district also includes portions of Johnston and Bladen County. 70% of voters in the 7th District are white, 21% are black, and 9% identify as Hispanic. Registered Democrats make up the lion's share of the district at 44%. Republicans claim 32.5%, and unaffiliated voters make up 23%. It was 2012 that David Rauser challenged Democratic incumbent Congressman Mike McIntyre for the seat in the 7th District. Rauser lost that election, but it was a close one. 2 years later, McIntyre decided not to run again, and David Rauser won the seat in a race against Democrat Jonathan Barfield. This year, he faces Democratic challenger Wesley Castine, whom we met on the October 6th edition of Coastline. Representative David Rauser, welcome to Coastline.
Great to be with you.
Representative Rauser, during your time in the North Carolina State Senate, you helped to get a law passed in 2012, I think it was, that barred state agencies from considering accelerated sea level rise in decision making until July of this year. This was essentially a moratorium on accepting recommendations from a science panel based on their research.
Well, you had to go back and look at what they were proposing at the time. They were basically saying, here's a model, and the model assumes that the sea level, for example, here in Wilmington, would rise by 39 inches within 100 years. Well, Rachel, we just had a hurricane come through. Mm-hmm. Was that model correct the entire time? No. So my point is this. How are you going to make a decision 100 years from, that's based on data, based on a projection 100 years from now, when we can't even get the hurricane forecast right 6 days out, 3 days out, 2 days out? Nobody anticipated the flooding that we've had in the inland part of this district. And it's because the models are not perfect.
And that's right. But Climate Central, which is made up of scientists and science journalists, it's been cited by the Associated Press, Reuters, all the major news networks, Nightline, Time, Scientific American, National Geographic. This group just published a study that shows that over the last decade, human-driven climate change has caused 82% of the flood days in Wilmington, North Carolina. It also says that in the last decade, human-driven climate change has caused 308 out of 376 flood days for Wilmington. Has your thinking on sea level rise and climate change changed at all in the last several years?
Let's talk about our areas of expertise and everybody's role in this. I'm not a scientist. I don't pretend to be a scientist. I do know this. Scientists disagree about what is causing climate change. I do know this.
The largest part of the scientific community says man-made climate change is a thing. Do you think it's real?
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're right. I was a chemistry major at NC State, and one of the things you learn early on in science is you have a hypothesis, and you keep trying to prove, until it's disproven. Well, the fact of the matter is none of this is absolutely proved to be true. We don't know yet. It's all based on models. Now, here's where I am. From a public policy standpoint, I don't look at it necessarily. I don't get in the middle of the debate between the scientists. What I say from a public policy perspective is we need to be basing public policy based on what we absolutely know to be the case, not based on a hypothesis.
And I don't want to shortchange you on this answer because I know it is nuanced. There's a lot to it. So we're going to go to a break and we'll come back in 90 seconds. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews today. Congressman David Rauser is with us. He's finishing out his first term, is seeking a second. He's facing a challenge this November by Democrat Wesley Castine. Thank you. Today, we continue with our Coastline candidate interviews, and on this edition, we'll meet North Carolina Representative Susie Hamilton, a Democrat from New Hanover County, who's held the seat for three terms and is seeking a fourth. But first, we're going to hear from her Republican challenger this November, Gerald Benton. North Carolina's House District 18 includes a northwestern portion of New Hanover County, most of the downtown area, and Wrightsboro, just south of Castle Hayne. The larger geographic part of District 18 covers a northern swath in Brunswick County, dipping down into parts of Winnebago and Leland. But from a population perspective, there are more voters in New Hanover. 64% live on the Wilmington side of the river. Across the entire district, Brunswick and New Hanover counties, 62% of residents are white, 31% are black, and 6.5% are Hispanic. Nearly 49% of the voters are registered as Democrats, 24% are registered Republicans, and about 27% are unaffiliated. And now we meet Gerald Benton, the Republican challenging incumbent Democrat Susie Hamilton. He is a disabled vet, a business owner, and a father. If you're leading with the issue of education, what is it then, if you didn't have to build consensus and you could just shape the system according to how you think it needs to go, how would you do that?
Well, I think we need to push for our educational savings accounts, which would wrap into the pre-K programs and the Head Start programs so that the money would be state deposited into your account. You could use that money at a school and put your child right into pre-K program and pay for whatever pre-K program you want, no state-approved system. That way, you can use what's convenient to you as a parent and what your goals are as a parent.
Why wouldn't you just put government money? Because critics of this idea would say you're taking money away from the public school system, and it's the state's responsibility to educate all children effectively.
Absolutely.
So why shouldn't the public school system then just get all of the resources and be the finest possible school system it can be so people don't want to send their children anywhere else?
Because money doesn't solve the public schools' issues, and they don't cater to all children equally. That is a huge issue. Government is very inefficient. They waste a lot of money.
Anna writes, I would like to know where the candidates stand on offshore drilling. Although we have been taken out of the federal plan for offshore drilling, Donald Trump and Pat McCrory have advocated for it in the past. Should Trump win the presidency, the federal plan may be altered to include North Carolina. If this were to happen, would you support a plan to drill or oppose it?
At this point in time, we no longer have a choice. It is approved in the state legislature. Representative Hamilton did vote to override Bev Perdue's veto. She was the overriding vote. She cast the one vote that put us over the edge to make that go through. So at this point, all we can do is make sure the environmental standards are open and public, because the way the law is written right now, once they tap in the ground, all of that becomes proprietary corporate information, all the environmental reports, and we can't see them. So I would probably propose here to make sure that those are public record. Because
are you talking about hydraulic fracturing or offshore drilling?
Well, both are going to be protected as corporate information. So we need to make sure that everything is transparent as possible. Like I said, at this point, it's very unlikely the legislature is going to overturn. I live on the river here. I mean, I go fishing. I have a boat. I live here, and I don't want to see any oil wash up on our beach, kill our wildlife. In fact, I'm a big proponent for, regulating commercial fishing down, oyster renewal, all those type of things, because I'm concerned about our natural resources. So
do you oppose or do you support offshore drilling?
If it can be done safely, I would support it. But we have to make sure that this is done correctly. We have to make sure the state also has regulatory action here and is keeping an eye on this, because we've seen now that the feds are not doing their jobs in regulating this properly, making sure the proper cement is being put in. There are a lot of concerns. I see a great opportunity for us to pull taxes in. I see a great opportunity for employment, but I've a lot of concern over the marine environment.
So it sounds like your gut reaction to this is no, I don't trust the process, but I'm open to...
I see a lot of benefit in doing it.
Okay, and tell us about that benefit.
I think that it will create jobs here, for sure. It's going to create tax revenue for us. We are able to issue permits and things like that, so we do get a lot of that money.
Well, we wouldn't be issuing any permits for offshore drilling, because that's federal waters, and so most of that money goes to the federal government.
The state had to put in the regulatory actions, and there, of course, all that's going to have money involved with us. So that there are... benefits here. There are jobs creations, not to mention people working on these rigs that would have to be stationed here because they're not going to fly them in from all over the country. A lot of infrastructure issues that they will need to be met, including their food, water being taken out to them. So those are more businesses that are going to be created that will create economic development here.
And to serve the crews on the oil rigs. Okay, Gerald Benton, you said across the board you're against corporate incentives. How do you feel about film incentives? Because that has been something that has been such an integral part of southeastern North Carolina's economic landscape.
Sure. At the state level, I do not support them. And the reasoning is we have two counties who primarily benefit, in Mecklenburg and New Hanover. And for us to go in front of 100 other counties and ask them to support a credit that only benefits two counties means we're indebted to them.
So how do you balance your responsibility towards the constituents here in southeastern North Carolina versus all of North Carolina? I mean, if you were elected, you are from this area, and your job, people elected you to represent them here.
Sure. No, I support a county incentive. I support an incentive at the state level that has a ownership issue, so it's more of an investment. So if we owned a small portion of the box office sales, if they took our money, that would be wonderful. I mean, we look at Iron Man, what was that, $1.5 billion. If we just had even a percent, it would have paid back everything we paid into the film, plus a little bit.
Well, they spent money here, and so we gave them a tax rebate.
We did, but we got no tax money off of it. And the best amount of money we ever recover off of the incentives, according to the film industry even, is like 75 cents on the dollar.
Susie Hamilton has served the district for 3 terms. She is seeking a 4th, and she joins us now. Representative Susie Hamilton, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel.
When you look back at the time that you've served, and you have been in the minority party, do you consider yourself a power broker? How do you get anything done?
Well, that's a fair question as well. I mean, it's just collaboration. There is outreach. You know, there's certainly more outreach from my side, from my end of the initiatives that I want to take and things that I want to accomplish. And I work very, very well in a bipartisan way. When we disagree, obviously we disagree sharply, but every issue creates a different opportunity. You really never know where your allies are going to be found. For instance, film. Danny McComas and I worked very closely together. We got the incentive program extended for 2 years, and in that 2-year period from 2012 to 2014, the state did record numbers of filming. That's the year we did Iron Man. I believe that we collected over $300 million in sales tax revenues and paid out right around 80, I believe.
Susie Hamilton, on your opponent's website, he accuses you of voting against a bill that would ban the sale of fetal tissue, baby body parts. There is a link to a story on WWAY-TV3 about an unrelated bill, a story about a bill that Governor McCrory signed in June of last year, which expands the waiting period for a woman to get an abortion. So let's just tease apart these issues here. First of all, why would you vote against a bill banning the sale of fetal tissue?
Because it was what I would refer to as a poison pill. It was put into the bill to defund Planned Parenthood. And I find the question ironic in the month of October being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, because Planned Parenthood does so many things for women's health and reproductive health across the country. And they fund free mammograms for women who otherwise may not be in a position to receive one. So, of course, I was unable to support a bill that defunded Planned Parenthood, no matter what was in it.
And what would you say to critics of Planned Parenthood who say that is an organization that sells fetal tissue and commercializes a horrible practice?
Well, that would be incorrect as well. And the facts don't support that they are in the process or they are in the business of selling body parts. So I think it's really a sensationalistic issue. It was intended to be. They knew we were all, as Democrats, going to vote against defunding Planned Parenthood. So they figured they'd just load it up with, whatever they could come up with, which knew would be distasteful to the public, and they put it in there.
The voter ID law in North Carolina was struck down by a federal appeals court described as targeting African Americans with almost surgical precision and imposing cures for problems that don't exist. And I think you've been fairly vocal about where you stand on that law to begin with. But what do you say to people who argue you need a state-issued ID to buy certain over-the-counter drugs at a drugstore? You need an ID to open a bank account, to apply for a job, to apply for unemployment, welfare, Medicaid, food stamps. You need a photo ID to apply for Social Security. So why shouldn't you need a photo ID to vote?
I think what you have to do is look very specifically at to what state IDs the legislation allowed. That was the problem with the bill.
Today, we're continuing with our Coastline candidate interviews. And on this edition, we meet the two people in the race for North Carolina Senate District 9. This district covers most of New Hanover County, with the exception of a small part of downtown Wilmington, which is part of Brunswick County Senator Bill Rabin's District 8. In North Carolina's 9th District, 80% of residents are white, 13% are black, and the rest of the population breaks out into multiple ethnicities. Senator Michael Lee, a Republican from New Hanover County, is seeking his second elected term in the November election. We have so many listener questions. I think we need to just start getting to those. And many of the people who wrote in wrote on the same subject, which is HB2, popularly known as the bathroom bill.
Sure.
This is something the Star News recently wrote an editorial about, talking about the stalemate between Governor Pat McCrory and the city of Charlotte. In the meantime, where do you stand on HB2? And what would you tell your constituents about what's going to happen with it?
Sure. And I'm going to give just a brief bit of background first, because a lot of folks that I've talked to haven't read the bill. So I think it's important to kind of walk through what my reasoning was for voting for the bill and talk about what's in it. Charlotte passed an ordinance that applied to everyone, small businesses, large businesses. And number one, they by statute didn't have the authority to pass the bill. In North Carolina, we have something called Dillon's Rule. So just as a threshold level, they didn't have the authority to do that. The second part of that really that relates to when I was reviewing it was really the bathroom piece, the bathroom locker room piece. And what the bill said, or the ordinance said, was essentially that you can't discriminate based on gender identity or gender expression, and then didn't define what that was. So, and it applied to YMCAs or any public accommodation, restaurants, swimming pools, whatever you can think of. And if my wife and I were to bring my daughter, who is 14 years old, to Charlotte to swim in a swim competition, she would be changing in a locker room where you had to allow someone who could be a 50-year-old transgender woman, anatomically a man, and that person could just take off all their clothes in front of our daughter.